My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest deployed to Afghanistan 3 times at the height of the conflict. In this episode, we discuss his childhood, developing obsessive compulsive disorder, how that impacted his well-being and his life in the military. We also look at politics and the future of veteran support. A Westminster special, Johnny Mercer. This is Declassified. Born in 1981 in Dartford, Kent. What did your mum and dad do for a living?
So my mum was a nurse. And my dad, he worked in like the local branch of Lloyds Bank. Ran the place like a pretty rigid operation. There was no problem with sort of over lending in those days. You asked my dad for a loan, and pretty much everyone got the same response.
What kind of nursing did your mum do?
So she was a children's nurse, but essentially, I mean, I've got 7 brothers and sisters, so she started having children pretty early on, and, you know, so there's 8 of us in the family home. It's a pretty full-time job.
Blimey. And what was it like then? So was he, I suppose you'd have to, if your dad was rigid at work and you've got 7 kids, was he 7 kids?
8.
8 kids?
Yeah.
What was childhood like growing up?
So it was a bit of a sort of military operation at home, you know, lining everyone up to go to school, the holidays, you know, we lived in Purley, in this house in Purley for a bit in South London. Get sort of lined up at the door with the boys, given £1 each, told to disappear into London for the day, come back at the end of it. It was great fun. A lot of it was fun, but obviously there were challenging aspects of it as well, which would then prove to be a bit problematic later on in life.
Were you close to your siblings?
Yeah, we were all very close. You know, over the years that sort of waxes and wanes, but we're very close now.
Mm. But growing up then, because was it a tight household?
Yes and no, because people left as soon as they were. So basically, when my older brothers got to the age of 16, where you could sign up, they were all sort of farmed off to the Navy. So we were close, but I guess there's 20 years between my oldest brother and my youngest sister, and there's definitely aspects, they would say, I think, of not really knowing who their brothers and sisters were because they were away from home all the time. Mm. So it's you know, swings and roundabouts. You know, during leave and stuff and during the holidays, I remember people being at home, but on the whole, there was a bit of a sort of split between the older guys who went off, joined the military, and then the rest of us were at home for a bit longer. Then I went and joined up when I was 19.
What are you in the pecking order then?
So I'm number 6.
All right.
6 of 8, yeah.
Right near the bottom.
Yeah.
Did you get an easier ride then? Normally it's the youngest.
Well, everyone, you know, likes to think that things get easier as life goes on. You know, you ask someone... you go to Armed Forces Day last weekend, and you know the commando course was obviously 10 times harder 10 years ago. Look, I think these things affect people in different ways, and you know, I think each of us had our challenges, and you know, and that, you know, that's the same in hundreds of families across the country.
Of course it is. Yeah. But we're focusing on yours today, and with that, there was quite a religious element to being brought up.
Yeah, so we grew up in a kind of like strict Baptist household where Baptist is quite a strict religion. Strict Baptistness is something that was definitely a challenge. And yeah, I mean, some of it I think was far too much, and I think made life very difficult. So, you know, regulating what you can read, what you can watch. No TV in the house when we're growing up. You know, Sundays were a beasting through many hours of services in chapels. And just made you a very, very different person to your friends, which, it was of course a challenge.
I mean, I was a non-religious household.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of discipline in our house. But what would be the difference? I can't quite understand that way of being brought up. Like, was it prayer? Was it kind of restriction in who you can
see. So a lot of it was based on this idea that a lot of it was guilt related, right? So everything you do is driven by guilt. And basically, you're just constantly making up all the time for perceived, what they would call kind of sins, right? And that induces in it a huge, yes, level of guilt, but also a great degree of fear of doing, you know, being seen not to honour this religion. And it also kind of, in my view, has given people, like any religion that goes too far, gives people an excuse to behave in an unacceptable manner, whether it's around violence in the family home, whether it's around sexual abuse in other areas of religion. Essentially, that was, you know, that was, well, but look, this was 1980s Britain, right? So, you know, there was no internet, no Facebook, no mobile phones, and people lived much more isolated lives. And so this stuff carried on, and, you know, perhaps my experiences weren't as bad as others. I don't know, really. I don't think you can really judge these things. I think some of my siblings were treated in an unacceptable manner. I think I was treated in a manner that was not acceptable. But that is my view as an adult. And, you know, and I'm not looking for any sort of recourse on that. You move on, but it doesn't alter the facts of what happened.
Mm. And then a childhood does impact you, like, throughout your life. Of course it does. It makes you who you are.
It has a profound effect, and it's had a profound effect on me as an individual. It's had a profound effect on my siblings. Aspects of it are good. You develop an extraordinary level of resilience. But far too much of it is not good, and life becomes a hugely challenging environment. Sometimes, you know, just normal things, and that's certainly where my kind of OCD grew out of, which has made, at times life extremely challenging. Yeah.
When did you first notice that?
So, I mean, the OCD stuff obviously starts when you're very young, but if you're in quite an isolated environment, you don't know what it is. So you're doing all this behavior and it's getting worse and worse and worse, you know, and you essentially, it's born out of anxiety, and you're checking things, you're having thoughts that you don't want, and you're just constantly fighting against a sort of impounding and an overarching anxiety. It wasn't until actually I went to the army. And, you know, I've been incredibly blessed with amazing friends who've always sort of seen all aspects of my life and, dealt with it in the most sort of caring and loving way. But it's certainly when I first really had a girlfriend, and, you know, because a lot of this stuff's secret, you do it at nighttime. But then, you know, when I first had a girlfriend and, she realised I was getting like 3 hours sleep a night. And, she first said, look, have you heard of OCD? And then when I went to see the quack, you know, they basically, I mean, it was obvious to me what was going on. And at that point, you can sort of start the recovery process, which is why it's so important to talk about these things. Because actually, had I gone when I was 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, my life would have been completely different.
Oh, so looking back, you can see then it was about 11 years old, wasn't it?
It started when I was about, I think when I was around 10 years old. So we had a sort of change in circumstance in my family. And I basically had a talent for singing, right? So I was a choir boy. And in 93, I came runner up in choir boy of the year, and this, you know, and then you start getting into music scholarships to go to get a posh schools, better schools, right? I went as a full boarder from the age of 7. So I left home at 7. And then, you know, the challenges from that, I think that is far too young for anybody to leave home for 3 weeks at a time. You know, particularly that particular home at that stage. I found it very difficult. When we started going to these other schools. But, you know, they also gave me an amazing, amazingly sort of privileged sort of way to educate and grow up, but it certainly came with its challenges.
And so if you could just go into like the OCD itself, like what, because I don't know what it is. And I obviously understand it, but I've never met anyone who's been open to talk about it. There's going to be people.
I mean, it's a bizarre illness. I mean, it's ranked as the fifth most debilitating illness
really?
On the planet. Yeah, which is extraordinary because there's this perception in the in society that it's about ironing your shirts and arranging your Coke cans in the fridge, right? I mean, yes, there's an element of that people do that to make themselves feel better, but that's not really OCD. OCD, obsessive compulsive thoughts and behaviour, is a really miserable place to be, where you know, the ability, you can't turn off, you can't rest, you can't get any peace. It's a constant state of anxiety around stuff that nobody else thinks about, you know, taps, switches, a sense of responsibility for things that have nothing to do with you. It's an incredibly difficult place to be, and you have to, you know, the key is to get in there early, because all you're doing whenever you're feeding it, you're kind of programming the machine to continue to behave like that. And as life goes on and it gets untreated, it gets worse. But all I would say to it all is that if you do seek that help, and you know, and it is, I mean, look at my life now, you know, this stuff barely impinges on it. It's the only reason I speak out, because actually if there'd been someone like me speaking out 30 years ago when I was a little boy really with OCD, really struggling, all the rest of it, and I'd seen someone like me speaking out, it would have fundamentally changed my life.
But yeah, sorry, man. So, but what was it on a daily bit? Like, I still don't understand what it was. So if there's someone listening who may be going through traits, who doesn't understand what it is, like when you were 10 or 11.
So what is it when you were 10 or 11?
What was it when you were 10 or 11?
Taps. So I worried that if I didn't turn off taps, basically there was going to be a flood and the whole building was going to fall down. It was all going to be my fault and everyone would be dead and it would be my fault. I mean, it's absolutely insane, right? But as a 10-year-old kid, you know, it's hard to deal with that. You think you attach meaning to things that just have no meaning whatsoever. So the way that you drink your last drink before you go to sleep at night, you want it to be in a specific way. Otherwise, it's just bizarre, but otherwise, you know, you're going to die in the night because you haven't. So you're seeking comfort from rituals and routines that are totally unnecessary, but essentially because you don't have those normal bastions and lighthouses of comfort, a stable family and a home and all the rest of it. You attach it to all this other nonsense and it just builds one on top of the other. If you then overlay that with a religion that's driven by guilt, it becomes a really toxic environment. So you are essentially told, you know, you say your prayers every night, and if you don't, you know, so you're basically, you're in the shit. And if someone dies, it'll be your fault, right? So that then becomes, as a 10-year-old boy, that becomes an incredibly, like, weird place to be. And you try and control your thought process through that. It's a circle from which it's very hard to extract without professional help.
I was just about to say then, before you mentioned control, is it a way of controlling something?
It's a way of controlling your circumstances around you, because for one reason or another, you've never had that, or you know, you don't have those elements of comfort, I think, that most healthy children have. Mm. And so you're kind of looking for that reassurance and that comfort in really strange places. And for me, you know, people go down different routes, but for me, this OCD thing developed and, it became, you know,
when did you first go for treatment?
So I didn't go for treatment until I was 21.
And it was daily from then, was it?
So
when I was at school, 19?
Between the age of 13 and 18, I mean, I got a scholarship to Eastbourne College. Really lucky to go there, big opportunities. I was getting about 2 hours sleep a night between the age of 13 and 18. Hence why my exams didn't go very well. I never really exceeded it too much. I mean, I was okay at sport and stuff, but anyone can do that. You know, in terms of, I never went to university. Because I was banging out 2 or 3 hours sleep a night. It was totally unsustainable.
What was the reason for that then? Was it just worry, constant
worry? Yeah, constant worry. To the point where it stops you sleeping. And then when you do sleep, you'll wake up in a state of anxiety with like a sweaty forehead, high pulse rate, and you'll think, what's going on? Oh, it must be the taps. And you'll go and check the taps again. Oh. Or it must be the lights. And you're trying to find an excuse. Yeah, yeah. And it starts to infiltrate your sleeping patterns as well. And that's what really drives the anxiety, because then you go to your classes during the day and start falling asleep. And you'd be in that place like when you're in a lecture at Sandhurst where you're like nodding off. And that would be your everyday, and it's like torture. It's like absolute mental torture.
Chronic fatigue.
Yeah, of course you get chronic fatigue.
Yeah. But would it fluctuate then between being at home and being away? Did you ever feel safe?
No.
For your full childhood, you didn't feel safe?
No, not at all. I used to sit and stare at the light in the bathroom that you could see was off, and go and wake up one of my sisters to tell me it was off, because I thought if I left it on all night, it would cause a fire, and my dad wouldn't be happy with that.
Did you have any safe havens? Did you go to like scouts or like a club? Was there anything where you felt like you could get away from it, or was it?
No, I always got away from it on my own. So I used to go, out on long sort of bike rides by myself. I used to go camping by myself, and just the odd night here and there. But I had some amazing friends. I've always been really lucky with my friends. And look, it was tough, but growing up, I think, is tough for a lot of people.
I mean, of course, and I think even just you explaining that then, I mean, if we stop the recording now and put that out, because my understanding's now changed. I had no idea about the sleep thing and the worry. And that says, I know people now, even just when you're speaking, that they wake up with anxiety.
Yeah, yeah.
And because they're worrying about something from the day before, instead of just allowing the thought to come and go.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like education was impacted, but then joining up, what was the thought process around that?
So, I mean, basically I got to the age of sort of 16, 17, 18, and I thought, so for me, in a way, it was kind of like, in a way, there was an element of proving that this stuff wasn't going to inhibit my life. And I remember when I was 17, 18, I met a couple of guys from Hereford who had left. They just got back from doing the Sierra Leone up in 98. And they were running some adventure training company. And I went and did 2 days with them to talk about potentially joining the army. And I remember I sat down with them and I said to them, they said two very clear things to me. I just wanted to get in the military to kind of get away from home, set up my own life, get paid, you know, start standing on my own 2 feet. And I, you know, I'd like to have gone in as a Tom, basically, into, you know, PWR as my local regiment or the parachute regiment or something like that. But they said two very clear things to me. So my question to them was, what's the hardest job to do in combat? And they said, probably the control of joint fires, actually in combat, close quarter combat with the enemy is very, very tough, because the mental agility required to do it is very difficult. And I thought, that sounds like something I want to do. And the other thing was, they said, look, I mean, if you don't particularly want to be an officer, you know, that's fine. But if you can be an officer, if you can let other people make that decision, then go to Sandhurst. It's an amazing privilege. So at least go and have a go. Go and do your RCB. I was 18 at the time, 17, 18. I wasn't going to go to uni. So I went and did my RCB at the time, which is what, like, the exams to get into officer school or whatever at Sandhurst. And I was given a Roe Allen company pass. So back in those days, basically, there were two courses that you got sent on if you weren't quite up to scratch to go to Sandhurst, right? I still can't believe they got away with this, but one of them was basically this beasting borstal for people like me who they thought he might have what it takes, but this guy needs to kind of, you know. But basically 42 of us started, right? 9 of us finished. Absolutely brutal. It was the last Rowland company they ever ran. They changed it into the Rowland Cardon and things like that, but it was never really the same. And then there was this pre-RMS course where they sent basically all the pikey officers like me to teach them how to eat properly in from these outsides, knife and fork, you know, go to the theatre and stuff. It's like you're treated like a gorilla, you know, that's being homeschooled, if you like. So I did these courses and eventually, went to Sandhurst. You know, and it was very clear to me, I wanted to do this joint fires thing as a commando. I just wanted to get a 2.9. in Plymouth, that, you know, from it's an extraordinarily special little unit, that focuses on this joint fires aspect of life. And that was my end state. There were two places in my year at Sandhurst, and I was going to get one of them.
Mm. Was it easier to be at Sandhurst than be at home? Did you find it easier?
Yeah, of course. I loved Rowland Company. Rowland Company is really what sort of straightened it out, because it was so brutal. It was so tough. You know, you turn up, they take your watches off you. So you've no idea what time it is, what day of the week it is. You go on exercise. It's not like you go on exercise now where it's all sort of planned and you get told all this and you can call your mum every night or whatever. Right? You would have 6 maps of training areas in the UK, Sennybridge, Dartmoor, wherever it may be, and all you would, and you're on constant readiness to go. So what would happen is, you'd be chilling out on a Sunday morning or even a Sunday night. I remember we launched at like 1 o'clock in the morning one night, and the staff come in, you know, they kick the door down. For the stripies and that, they love it. I mean, it's great. They just get to absolutely beast posh kids for 12 weeks. I mean, what's not to like, right? And you would then get told to parade outside. You wouldn't be told where you're going. You're just getting a 4-tonner. Now, you could be in that 4-tonner for 2 hours going to Salisbury Plain. You could be in that 4-tonner for 14 hours going to Scotland. And then you would get out and you'd have to find out where you were just by looking at these maps, trying to ascertain where you were. And then you go on these, you know, these exercises, because it's non-tactical, right? So there's no weapons or anything like that. It's literally survival. And, you know, you'd be told to be in RVs at different times. You'd do a good 2-day, 2-night walk on the first night. And for a lad like me, and for many people, I think, who'd never done anything like that, you know, you have to search your soul to get through it. And obviously, you know, lots of people don't. But I think for those who do, I can genuinely say now, hand on heart, it's the best thing I ever did.
Mm.
It was harder than commander course, harder than selection. It was, Rowland Company.
I've never
heard of it.
For those
who've done it, I know, for those who've done it, it holds a special place in their heart.
Did you, I kind of going back a little bit to come forward, was you sleeping better than at this point?
Yes, because I was just exhausted. So I would go to, you know, you wouldn't finish till sort of 1-2 in the morning, you'd be up at 5. I was like, this is easy, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years. And it, you know, the wonderful thing, I think the military is just such a power for good. You know, it teaches you what you're capable of, but it also teaches you what, is beyond you. So you get that humility as well, and that confidence to accept your shortcomings.
Yeah.
You know, and reliance on people who have different strengths to you. It was a wonderful experience, and it made me who I am.
Mm. When we when you went to 2.9, did the all arms course, went to 2.9.
Yeah.
Had you found your place there then?
Yeah, I knew when I turned up to 2.9, I went out on the battlements first night I got there, and I just knew that this was going to be my home.
Mm.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, people have that with different regiments, but just the ethos, the man, the regiment. was me. And, you know, right from the old and bold who looked after me as a 20-year-old, 21-year-old young officer who, you know, was probably a bit too crazy and, you know, got too sort of stuck in and all the rest of it, to my mates who I did that with at the time, fellow junior officers, we all became incredibly close, and became friends for life, you know. But then obviously we all went through the Afghan process, which had a pretty significant effect on my peer group.
What year did you get to 2009?
2003.
And Herrick 5, what was...
That started in 2006. So I had, you know, so the regiment came back from Iraq in September 2003, if I remember correctly. We then had a couple of 3 years of 2 years of great times. You know, we at that time you were doing three exercises a year. So you'd do Norway, do 3-4 months in Norway, which was brilliant. You'd do a med trip, or for me, I went to Belize and did my jungle warfare training, and then there'd be a Black Horse deployment exercise, Black Horse, which was to the States in the autumn. So you're on this rotation. And it's great fun, you know, lots of time away, messing about in ports in the US, you know, Belize City, wonderful place. Can't tell the stories of that place anymore, but it was great, you know, and it was what being a junior officer should be like.
Is that during that period then? Is that when you went to the doctor for the OCD?
So... yeah, that was when I first started getting treated for my OCD with something called cognitive behavioural therapy. So I had a couple of really good medical officers down at 2-9 who I could actually engage with and who started the big task of trying to get this whole thing under control.
And what was the process? And was there a stigma around it? Did you feel comfortable?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there were people who clearly... you know, mental health is going through a generational change. And there were people, really dear friends of mine, who just didn't get it. But they still had the empathy and the humanity to be like, you know, just do what you need to do. So I must say that the stigma around mental health, I have not experienced it to the level of other people. I guess because I've always been quite shameless about it and quite sort of, you know, that's kind of me, right? And
it does, but it also, sorry to interrupt you, but it also seems like it was absolutely horrendous going through your full childhood explaining. So I don't downplay that. I think you've been very resilient as a child and then growing up.
Yeah.
And then you've managed to be self-aware and then nip it in the bud early.
Yeah.
Early into your adult life.
Yeah. I was lucky. My friends were incredibly supportive. You know, I had friends like Jim Phillipson, who was the first officer to die in Afghan, actually, in 2006. You know, who was just brilliant about it. I mean, we used to, you know, when we were doing the exercises in America, you know, you're going at like 9 miles an hour across the Atlantic on a RFA ship, right? So you're for 2 weeks, you're going in a straight line on a ship. There is nothing to do except fizz and drink and chat to your mates. And that's, you know, and you become incredibly close to people. You know, and these guys were incredibly supportive. Another guy, Jimmy Goddard, you know, a friend of mine. These guys were incredibly supportive.
How long did therapy last, that initial bout?
So a CBT course is generally, you know, 6 to 8 sessions. That worked to a certain extent. But it's what I didn't realise at the time is mental health is not a thing where you take a pill or do a course and it's all over, right? You have to manage this condition. This is the way you are made. And you have to have the resilience and the discipline to treat what is going on, whether it's depression, anxiety, OCD like I had. And I hoped for a long time that course would just sort of see me through. And it did for a while. But this is behaviour learned over 20, 25 years. And you have to work at your health, mental health and well-being. And I didn't, I realise that now, and I spend a lot of time working on it. I go running every day, you know, not because I'm training for a marathon, but simply because of my mental health, right? So it's something you need to keep at, but I didn't realise that at the time. And so consequently, I do my course, I'll be like, yes, I feel Olympic, you know, there's nothing wrong with me, that'll happen to someone else, let's, you know, let's crack on. And the reality, you know, obviously that hits reality, and it's not the case. And actually, you'll have these compulsions and a lot of this stuff for the rest of your life, but you can manage it and you can have a totally, almost totally uninhibited life from it if you have the courage to face it and genuinely commit yourself to getting better.
Yeah, I suppose the even just like the fizz element, the camaraderie of being in two now as well, and being that kind of regiment where it's competitive and it's like hyper physical. The only good stuff from that.
It was competitive, but also mature,
humble.
It was competitive but humble. Humility's been a big thing for me in the and that's why, you know, there were aspects of the military that I find quite challenging to get alongside, that, you know, the sort of I don't particularly now, I find it hard to recognize some of my peers who went through that experience as well. I don't the sort of bragging or the kind of this broken veteran thing, you know, I don't really recognise it, but people deal with it in different ways. For me, humility is a massive part of being in the military and a massive part of life in general. And consequently, 2-9 was the place for me. Do we get it right all the time? No. Was it perfect? No. But for me, you know, that regiment was me. And I was very proud to serve.
Herrick 5.
Yeah.
What was your role?
So I was an OMLT commander with 4-5 commando. So basically it was me. So in the early days of the operational mentoring liaison teams. So it was me, 3 bootnecks and 92 crazy Afghans, right? Trying to form an army, take them on, you know, you do 6 weeks training, 6 weeks ops, and then they go on leave for 6 weeks, and then those of them that had a brain obviously didn't return. So there was like a 80% desertion rate. I didn't really get up to much in that tour, and in fact, I wasn't there for very long because my first, you know, they're quite rigid about your tour times, right? And if your 3-year point comes up at a regiment, you move on. So I then left there and went and did phase 2 training at Larkhill, and which was great because, again, I was just incredibly lucky to have a commander called Taff Cayleys, who that's where I properly piled in for the first time in the military with my OCD, and it just became a bit too much. And I remember him sitting me down one morning. I can't remember what had happened. I think So something triggered it, but I can't remember what it was. But I just remember this acceptance that actually I was pretty poorly and I needed to go on medication. I remember him sitting me down, and he's like this Grizzly Ellie officer, lovely guy, Welsh, mad, lots of dogs, runs all the time. But he just said to me, look, you know, you're incredibly lucky to be in the sort of environment where you can go and get better. Right, you can, the army, you know, for better or worse, it's finding its way with this mental health stuff, but there is an opportunity now for you to get better, and you should take that opportunity and really apply yourself to it, because you could kind of put this in the box where it can be managed for the rest of your life. And you can't do that always, you know. You know if as a civvy you have to go out, earn the money, keep your family and so on. You can't, you know, sometimes people don't have the time and the space to get better. He said, now is your moment to get better, whatever it is, get better. And it was quite powerful, actually. So I went and did another course of CBT down at Tidworth, and I went on meds, and I slowly got a grip of it. And in that period at Larkhill, in that year-long period, finally sort of started to be able to really tackle it in a deep and meaningful way.
Mm. What kind of meds was it? Was it antidepressant?
Anti-anxiety stuff, things like
okay.
that. Yeah.
Was you, and I'll come back to sleep again because I think it's such an important part.
Yeah.
Was you sleeping then?
No. I mean, this continued, right? The whole lack of sleep thing continued. So I loved being on exercise. Right, because when I was on exercise, I didn't have to worry about washing my hands or being particularly clean or worrying about X, Y, and Z. Plus, I was getting like 4 or 5 hours sleep a night. I mean, that was a lion for me at the time, right? So I loved being on exercise. When I then went to Lock Hill and I was, I was basically taking phase two training.
So he was a troop commander looking after 30
troop commander
young blokes.
Phase two. So, yeah, obviously the guys go through phase one. They do their phase two special to arm training.
So that's the artillery stuff.
Came to Lock Hill and we did that. And it was great. I had a good training team. And we basically rewrote the kind of syllabus because we were just firing into Afghan at the time and had, you know, just walked into a bit of a hornet's nest. And the level of soldiering required was not matched by the offer coming out of phase one and phase two. Some of us tried to sort of put that right. We rewrote the syllabus and tried to train people up, to make sure that at least people could do fairly sort of basic stuff that they were asked to do within the PBs, which at the time were, you know, as they were right through till about 2010, 2011, you know, if you're in the wrong PB, it can be a fairly sort of brutal summer. So, you know, I enjoyed that challenge and I took the time to get better.
Was there a responsibility on you then, training these young lads? As in, did you feel a pressure on you to make sure these guys were good enough so when they went out to look after themselves?
Yeah, not too much because it wasn't just about me, right? So there's a training team, there's a regiment, there's a battery commander. No, I didn't really feel the pressure. I enjoyed it, if I'm honest. And it was one of the most rewarding sort of parts of my career where you get... You know, it's one thing, the military is a lot of things and it gets some things wrong, right? But one of the things it does so well is getting guys in from, you know, sometimes from a pretty rough background where they've had no male figure in their life before and all the rest of it, and actually turning them into a seriously professional soldier, individual, who can go and operate at the highest level, you know, within UKSF or wherever it may be. And it's a really powerful story that the military has in that department that I'm afraid we don't talk about anywhere near as much as we should do.
Mm.
And I loved having a hand in that, you know, guys coming in and, you know, their idea of smart casual is like a matching tracksuit from JD Sports, you know, and then 4 years later meeting them at the top of some mountain, you know, on selection, wherever it may be, and hearing they've gone off to have these amazing careers. That was one of the best, that's one of the best times I had.
Mm.
Definitely, yeah.
Just fast forward us then to Herrick 12, around 2010.
Yeah.
You'd been, obviously, to Afghan twice before that. This was the third time.
Yeah.
And this is when your job role shifted slightly. And
Yeah. So I was basically a terminal controller, which means you do all the sort of indirect weapon systems like guns and jets and helicopters and missiles and all that. Obviously flying into targets, you've got very small specialist teams next to the target to make sure you obviously do a correct weapon target match, you get hit the right people or the right building or whatever it is. And I was sort of on the front edge of that, of a transformation towards a away from in the artillery where you had FOOs, forward observers, who generally do artillery and mortars and that, into FSTs, which was where you'd be expected to do everything. And I'd sort of worked through some of the early days trying to replicate what the Anglico teams do in the US, where they have a much more sort of all arms concept. And then took that out to Afghan again in 2010. That was kind of like, if you look at ticks, if you look at significant SIGAC, significant activities, I mean, 2010 was kind of the height of the insurgency in Afghan. So as a terminal controller in Nadi Ali, a place that we hadn't held for a summer before, it was obviously quite busy, yeah.
Was you on the summer tour?
Yeah.
And just explain exactly what you were doing.
So my responsibility was that I had a team of four other soldiers. And our responsibility was to, whenever you go out on the ground and you come, you know, if you're doing ground dominating, so the previous tour that I won't go into too much, a small unit that was doing sort of manhunting, you're doing deliberate operations going after people. Ground hauling is very different, as thousands of your listeners will know. You know, you're trying to do GDA patrols every day. You're going out morning, evening, last light, first light. And the trouble is, in Nadi Ali at the time, they cleared down through there the winter before, and the Americans had pushed up from Marja. And so they created this, what they call a cat triangle, where sort of all the badness of Helmand had, or a lot of it, had decided to sort of set up camp. And then we were the main patrol base, sort of trying to police that area for the first summer in 2010. And you would go out and, people do terminal controlling in different ways. For me personally, I always wanted to make sure that I was personally closest to the bomb whenever it went off, as a sense of responsibility, but also the situational awareness I had from being in these particular areas. So that would mean that I'd go on, one of my blokes would go on every patrol, usually it was me, and you're just, for 7 months, you're just walking into ambushes. And obviously ambushes are a bit of a nightmare because you're contacted not at a time when it's good for you, right, but at a time of the enemy's choosing. And so 9 times out of 10, it's just chaos. Mm. And you have to, for me, the way I used fires was that obviously most people die in the first 3 or 4 seconds of a contact. You have to try and regain the initiative as fast as you can. And that's where things like artillery and so on are just really useful. If you can walk along on patrol and you're constantly marking what you call silent targets, so you're thinking, right, if we come under contact here from over there, I'm going to drop a bomb over there. And that's going to basically just, in some ways, sometimes just, you know, you're not firing shells into villages. Sometimes you're just changing the dynamics of a situation by landing a shell close-ish to a compound where it will frag the compound, and whoever's firing out of it is going to think twice about doing it again. But that's how you survive ambushes, right? The idea you can get ambushed and then, you know, get your cigarette out and think, oh, I think they're in there. Yes, we'll have a laser-guided missile go straight. It's not reality. The reality of close-quarter joint fires is that you just do the best with what you've got, and you need to react fast in order to change the dynamic of what's going on. And, you know, and I was just really proud of a lot of my guys. I think, you know, they saved a lot of lives in operating in the way that we trained to do. I think the story of terminal controllers in Afghan, in Helmand in particular, hasn't really been told yet. I think it's some incredibly brave people who do some really difficult, if you can imagine, you know, the scenario where people have been shot and killed in an ambush and suddenly you're surrounded and everyone's looking to you to call in some artillery, to get a jet on station, to get an AH on board, and deliver that effect on the ground. But, you know, first couple of times it's great, you know, but after a while, when ground forces then start doing things they wouldn't do if you weren't there, i.e. going into the sort of heart of darkness, if you like, and giving these guys a shake, that then induces quite a lot of pressure on you as an individual, and after a bit, that I did start to find that difficult. But I think that's normal, you know.
Well, you're in an amazing situation what only a few people in the world will ever experience, and no one will ever experience like you did then. And the talk about the pressure. What kind of pressure is it? Well, why is it like the relentlessness of being ambushed? Is it the pressure you've got on yourself?
It's just the pressure you've got on yourself. So, look, I mean, I know 3 or 4 of my mates who have dropped things in the wrong places and, you know, killed people. Sometimes UK soldiers, right? The pressure of doing joint fires is immense, because it can be incredibly powerful. And change the dynamic of what's going on. If you think you've gone into a complex ambush where you've been hit by an IED, there's a guy rolling around without a leg, and suddenly you're getting smashed by a Dushka as well.
The only way you are really going to change the dynamics of that situation, you can all have a pop with your firearms and all the rest of it, but you don't really know where anyone is. The only way you're really going to extract from that is by using some sort of joint fires. The pressure to do that is tough because people are dying, right? You take your time, you mess it up, people are going to die. So, you know, the pressure from that is significant. But I was lucky because I just had a really great team. I had a brilliant ACK who unfortunately was killed on the in June of that year, 8th of June 2010. We were engaged in sort of a pincer movement on a Taliban position, and him and I crossed the road and we just got victualled up by a burst of fire and he just got shot straight in the face. You know, but these were exceptional people, and that's what drove me into politics, because I felt that this nation, the people got it. You know, that you can see the outpouring through Help for Heroes and stuff like that. They absolutely got it. The government, in my view, has never got it and still doesn't get what it owes to these extraordinarily brave people.
Is that why you left then?
Yeah, so I left because I kind of reached the end of the road as well. So, you know, at the end of my tour in 2010, the Afghan thing is interesting if you're in combat all the time, because you feel like parts of it are addictive, right? But you also feel like at times like increasingly lucky. And I remember going out some days just like absolutely convinced I was going to get shot, absolutely convinced. And that fear is extraordinary. And it is like a bit like a bank account. And the first few times it happens, you know, it didn't happen till 3-4 months into the tour. But then the first few times you go out and you think, yeah, you know, we're probably going to die today. You could deal with that, but after 7 or 8 times, you start to think might be time to do something else for a job. And then you come home, you come back to the field army, and everything's different. I found the culture around Afghan at times quite hard to deal with. You know, people wanted to do Afghan to get it on their ticket, and I found that very difficult, because whilst I understood that, actually a lot of it, some parts of it were horrific. And I saw what it, you know, my friends had been killed, some of them seriously injured. I'd seen what it had done to their families and so on. So whilst, you know, people, young lads will always want to go on operations, I think there's a line, and you don't want to push it too hard. And I found the increasing culture around commanders who just wanted to do Afghan, and then, you know, the way they would come out, and I saw a lot of commanders because I was doing their fires. So I worked very closely with company commanders and COs and things like that. And just for some of them, an unhealthy attitude started to develop around, you know, they wanted to do Afghan. They wanted to, it was as though the war was waiting for Major X or Lieutenant Colonel Y to come out and finally win the war for the British in Afghanistan, because they all had these, you know, latest bright idea. And I just found it very wearing, and I thought it was some of it was pretty unfair on the guys like me who'd been there a number of times and sort of knew what it was like, not in a way that we would be sort of, you know, forceful about it, but just much more cognizant of the risks and therefore having a slightly different attitude to what was going on. I think the Afghan experience split the military as much as it did, you know, people in civil life who are upset about Iraq or Afghanistan. For me, you know, lots of people went to Afghanistan, right? 1 in 9 actually deployed outside the wire. 1 in 9. And a lot of the fighting was borne by a relatively small number of people, and that in and of itself brought challenges. It was very hard for those of us who engaged in fighting to understand why people were so keen to go out and get stuck in after a bit. And you know, I don't want to speak out of turn. I respect people who want to just go out and kick the whole place down and get stuck in. But, you know, when I was on my third tour by that stage. And I just thought to myself, you've got to be careful what you wish for.
Well, experience dictates a lot, and you know, those learning points that get highlighted, and your own experience, like I said, like that shapes who you are. Then leaving, was it then politics? Was you purposely
So I came back in 2010. I started running the commando course for 2-9, which was great fun, and you know, we got a hoofing pass rate off it, and it was great. In 2012, more of the blokes took their own lives and were killed in the conflict. So this veterans care thing really bit me, because I saw the difference between... It's hard to explain why it's so visceral, but I would see the difference between people like Mark Chandler, who was my guy who died, other people who were incredibly brave, and often unnoticed, representing the very best of junior command in the British Army. And I saw that matched by a government that, in my view, talked a good game, but ultimately didn't really care. And politicians at the time will deny that and say they cared and they did this and they did that. But ultimately, for veterans care to be in the place where it was in 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10, is a derogation of duty over a number of years by those in political office. And I felt I realised my time in the military was probably coming to an end. I wasn't really ever going to be anything special, because I struggled with the whole sort of officer side of things. I thought, yeah, well, time's probably up. In 2012, we reached that threshold. And I remembered actually during the tour we didn't talk about, when I was doing the sort of strategic stuff, briefing ministers on what was going on, who would come out to this. I remember looking at them and just thinking, if I was in your position, I'd change so much. I would, you know, I'd fire into veterans care. I'd try and totally reset this country's relationship with her military that, in my view, has got so out of kilter. And so I thought, yeah, I'm going to try and be an MP. But I had no idea where to start. I never even voted. I didn't know any MPs, didn't know anyone in any political parties. Politics to me was like, you know, the sort of preserve of the slightly weird and deluded. And obviously some of that hasn't changed. But I do think that, you know, it was a bit of a closed shop, and I basically had to find my own way through it.
Was you married with kids then when you left?
Yeah. So, I mean, I went to school with my wife, we were apart for a while, and then back in 2008, 9, we got back together, and we've got two kids, and I was married, yeah. So it was a big leap to go from, and I would strongly advise no one to ever follow me, much like when I was serving, actually. It was a big leap to go into this employment now, which is desperately unstable and pretty risky. I was incredibly lucky. You know, I've never really had these, you know, sort of gifts that people, you know, write nice things about me and so on. I've just been incredibly lucky.
Well, what do you keep saying lucky, and I'm not,
because I think so
that.
Much of it is luck. So I was in the pub last night with a guy who I served with, and we were talking about the elements of what role luck has to play in life. He's got a very important job now, you know, I've got this job, and there was absolutely no way 15 years ago when we were first together that you'd have thought we'd ended up where we are. I think, yes, you can work hard and you can narrow the odds in your favour. But ultimately, a lot of things come down to a lucky break here or there, which is why, you know, I spend a lot of my time now sort of looking behind me and trying to pull people through with me, because I feel like I've just been very fortunate to be where I am.
Did you, the campaign, is that my right in saying you funded the campaign?
Yeah, so basically when people have a complete misperception of politics, right, you get into it and suddenly the Conservative or Labour Party get you in, throw loads of money at you and tell you to go and win a seat. It's absolute rubbish, right? You come in, it's all a voluntary organisation. Yes, you can play the system, play the game, try and get in with the Tories or Labour and try and get a safe seat where they're always going to vote Labour or always vote Tory. I just wanted to be the MP in Plymouth, right? I loved Plymouth. It's where my regiment is, my friends and family. But generally speaking, in politics, you can't change a seat like that.
It was North Brimford was a Labour seat, always had been. Had a guy called Michael Foot in it, you know, who was pretty sort of socialist and left wing. I remember sitting down with the Tories at the time. And they said, "Look, if you want to do this, you're on your own because it can't be done." But I thought I made a calculated decision that the worst thing wouldn't be losing the election. The worst thing would be not reaching people like me who weren't interested in politics. Because I didn't think politics was dead. You know, this is after the Obama thing where so many people voted for him who'd never voted before. I don't think politics is dead. People just want it done differently. And I felt passionately about it. And everyone told me I was wrong, which is fine. But I genuinely sort of believed it. So I drew up a map of Plymouth, with my wife. My wife's brilliant at this stuff. I mean, you know, I still think most people think they're voting for her, actually. But we drew up Google Maps, marked up every house, and we were like, right, went out December 2014, how many of these houses can we bang on in a day? And then transpose that back from the 7th of May, printed out my own leaflets, just went door knocking, said, "My name's Johnny, I'm from the Citadel. I'd love to be your MP. I'm sick of the way politics works in this country. I'm determined to change it. Give us a shot." And they did.
Did you mention the military link?
Yeah, of course.
Was that a bit, of course, yeah, it's value. You're adding value
and trust. Plymouth's a proud military city.
Mm.
So I'd say, you know, I wouldn't sort of overplay it. I'd just say that was my history.
Well, I'm not questioning it.
I'd be like...
It's connecting with people.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say I was up at the Citadel, up at 2-9. So everyone knows the Citadel in Plymouth is... The base at 2-9 is a really... It's basically a castle up on the hill, right? So everyone knows where it is. Everyone knows, it is Plymouth. And everyone in Plymouth knows what 2-9 is. And so I'd say, I just left. I'm sick of the way politics happens and I want to be an MP. I want to be your MP and try and get a better deal for Plymouth, mental health, young people, the forces. I mean, those have always been my four strands.
Say that again.
Plymouth, yeah. I think, has had, if I'm honest, not very good politicians of all colours over the years. And consequently, our settlements are from government around schools, education, transport. Addiction services, as you know, was going on today, are nowhere near what they should be. Young people, I think one thing I found really frustrating coming through the system is how people sort of 20, 30 years older than me, absolutely nothing in common with me, as politicians would tell me what was good for me and what they thought I should aspire to be and what they thought I needed help with. I feel that young people in this country still, it's changed a lot in the last 3 or 4 years, but I still feel that young people are slightly sort of demonised. I'm absolutely determined to be their voice and represent them. Mental health, obviously, is a huge driver for me. Politicians talk about parity of esteem between physical and mental health. Well, that means nothing unless you can actually deliver a parity of services. And people can actually access mental health treatments in our communities. And we've got a long way to go on that. And the military. Look, I think that my personal view is that the relationship between the military and the nation in this country needs to be completely reset.
Mm.
You know, military spending, veterans care, housing, welfare, what the military is actually there for, operations, the whole thing needs to be reset. We've got some amazing people working in defence and in the military, but it needs, in my view, a bit of a reset. That's why I'm here, basically. I'm trying to do that. I make no bones about it. That's what I'm trying to do. I haven't been, hugely successful so far, but it's been quite a turbulent period in politics.
There's a few of you in government now that were regular, former regular serving, but the vast majority not. Do you feel that, or what is the kind of feeling in Westminster? Is it on our armed forces, especially the veteran community, is it a hero victim kind of narrative? Is it just like we've got a national asset?
There's a lot more goodwill now since Iraq and Afghanistan because it became very visceral. In my view, that's not matched by genuine action, and there is at times a lack of genuine understanding of the issues. So, for example, this historical allegations thing is a classic case in point because people want to jump on it and say amnesty or statute of limitations or all these things, which A, will never happen, B, both sides don't want, and C, wouldn't solve the issue anyway. And they have really put forward really passionate cases for these things without actually thinking it through. And consequently,
when this passion without any direction meets reality, nothing changes for the guys. And for me, I judge myself on how I alter people's lives in those most hardest to reach areas, whether it's veterans who are trying to access mental health treatment, whether it's people's job prospects in Plymouth. You can make all the noise you want to, but if it doesn't change anything, it means nothing. And you know, that's how I kind of judge myself. At times I've been very successful. The Iraq Historical Allegations team, you know, I took a stand on the Northern Ireland prosecutions thing about 6 weeks ago, and now legislation's coming through. But I've had to do things in a slightly different way, I think, to a lot of my peers in politics. And some people don't like that. You know, some of my peers don't like that, and that's fine. But I didn't really come to London to create a sort of social circle for myself. I came to speak for people whose voices have not been heard for far too long, in my view. And so I probably won't be changing anytime soon.
And of course, you spend a lot of time in London, which means you're away from your family. It's got to have some meaning.
Yeah,
behind
I mean,
it.
This job is not fun. You know, I don't particularly enjoy it at the moment. Yes, I'm away from my family a lot. I live in a hotel. You know, 15 years ago, I would have thought that was an amazing privilege to live in, you know, a hotel in London and go to work and all the rest of it. The reality is that politics is a very unpleasant place to be at the moment. And you have to have, I think, a degree of resilience that, you know, perhaps politicians haven't had to have too, you know, they've had resilience, but now more than ever, I think, in the advent of social media, the competing pressures on you, the two main parties in this country are at a real turning point, I think, and are very fractured at the moment. So they're not really there to look after the individual MPs and provide them with the support and the vehicles and the mechanism for getting things done and, you know, representing your city in London. I think... politics is in a pretty dark place, but I think it always gets darkest at just before the dawn. I think change is coming, and that's why I'm hanging around.
Do you or how do you look after yourself? Because you do take on occasion a bit of hammering on things like social media, and you're very outspoken. from a personal point of view, you have a lot of integrity, and you try and follow things through. And the Iraq allegations, excuse me. It was a prime example of that. And then all the stuff with Northern Ireland and the future of that. But you do take flak. Do you read social media? Do you engage with it? Because I know it has affected you, because we've had a conversation before.
Yeah,
and it might get you down like it would anyone. But how do you bounce back? Like, how do you?
Right. So the reality is this: is that everyone's got an opinion, right? And I respect that, whether it's informed or not. Is another issue that every individual has to make a judgment on. Ultimately, do I care what people think of me? There's an element of that because I have to get elected, right? But ultimately, if I do what I think is the right thing, not based often on my personal judgment, but by speaking to close friends, people who are in certain positions maybe within the military or government, or, you know, and they can't say these things. If I know I'm doing the right thing, then I'll stick to it, come what may. And I genuinely don't really care for the criticism if I'm doing the right thing. But I don't always get it right. And I have made mistakes over the last 6 months. And, you know, you learn from them, and I will learn from them going forward. But ultimately, do I really, really care about the abuse? No. It doesn't bother me. You know, it comes from people I've never met who don't know me, who that is a major part of their day, slinging mud at an MP. Fine. You know, people try, and there are people who wake up in Plymouth, right? There are two or three people who wake up in Plymouth every day. Their number one occupation is to make me lose my job. You can't let that stuff bother you. Otherwise, you won't do anything.
The last time I saw you, you was with your daughter, right?
Yeah.
You was with your daughter, and I asked her if she was proud of her dad, and she said yeah, and we had a nice conversation.
Aww.
And are you proud of what you're doing?
I'm very cognizant of the privilege I have. Lots of people have, you know, wanted to be MPs or tried to be MPs, and I know that the journey that I've taken is a very sort of privileged one, and I'm not going to throw it away or waste that opportunity. I don't really have too much sort of pride. I take pride from other stuff, to be honest, like hanging out with the family and you know, trying to learn how to surf properly and things like that. I do, you know, because all this stuff to me is so kind of fickle. I mean, I'm always drawn back to, you know, if you've been in ambushes where literally it's just luck that a guy next to you gets shot in the face and you don't, it does bring a sense of, I think, perspective to these things where you can do your best. Ultimately, with all these things, you can do your best. You can have all the odds in your favour. You can work all the hours God sends, try and get veterans care right. But then ultimately you're going to need a prime minister to come in who's going to grip it as well. And there's not a lot you can do about that. That depends on a lot of other factors. So what I'm trying to say is that so much of this is outside of your control, is that all you can do is make sure that you're part of SHIP, your job, your responsibility, your roles, your family, your friends, you can square away that. And then whatever happens, happens. There's no point getting upset about it.
Cheers, Johnny, and we will leave it there.